यावान् अर्थः उद्पाने सर्वतः संप्लुत उद्यते तावान् सर्वेषु वेदेषु ब्राह्मणस्य विजानतः. This is one of those verses that's very often quoted from the Gita. Yavan Artha. Artha can mean meaning, has many meanings actually. Artha has many meanings. One of the meanings is meaning. Another meaning is the purpose or the reason or the aim for something, the purpose of it. So here, Yavan Artha, like Pala, we have the same sense of Pala, result of the purpose, the reason, Prayojana. So Yavan Artha, we would say, as much use, this Yavat Tavat, this is Yavan Tavan in the nominative singular, Yavat Tavat. As much use as this would be, so much use that would be. See, like that. As much good that you get out of this, that much good you get out of that. So Yavan Artha, as much use as you would get, Yavat Artha, purpose is Artha, use or purpose, okay, Artha. Udapane, in a well, as much use as you would get out of a well, in English we say, get from a well. Sarvataha, sampluta udake, when water has flooded everywhere. So then in the Bhasha, Shankara says, you know, whether it be a well or a little reservoir or a little pond, some small body of water, if there's been a flood that has flooded over all of those small bodies of water, like the well or the little pond, then really, what is the purpose now? You know, what is the purpose now of that little well? And in fact, where is it? Right? Because it's totally flooded over by water. So as much use as you would get from a well when water has flooded everywhere. Okay. So in there the word, let's see where we're at. Sampluta means flooded. Udaka means water. It's an absolute locative of the water. When the water has flooded, sarvataha has it indeclinable, when the water has flooded everywhere, what use is there for the well? How would you use the well? Tavat, tavan, that much. That much use. Sarveshu Vedeshu, in all of the Vedas, Brahmanasya Vijanataha. For the Brahmana Vijanata, who knows? Means who has self-knowledge. So here's a few things. First of all, by the meaning of Brahmana, it's the one who has the sattva guna. Means their mind is predominantly sattva. So they have a shantavritti. In fact, if I went through, the four vargas, the brahmana, which really are your scholars and teachers and the sannyasis, become the sannyasis. They are predominant, their vritti, their mind is predominantly sattva. Whereas the kshatriyas are predominantly rajas with sattva as a secondary. Right? So they have a lot of energy and want to rule and govern, you know, and can have force and anger. But because of the sattva, because they have sattva, they are the upholders of dharma, right? Because the sattva gives them that heart for, or that reflection of the self, I would say, the ananda or the goodness of your own nature that allows that to be predominant in their disposition. So a kshatriya is said to be predominantly, right, rajas with sattva secondarily. The vaishya is said to be rajas with tamas secondarily. So the vaishyas are, well, let's say it. Trump. The Vaishyas really are the business people, the business world. Right? The business world. And so the business world are not necessarily, they can be, because you don't need to be categorized like this, but say if you fall into this categorization, it would be that you are driven really toward boga and aishwarya, gaining wealth and gaining stature and power. So the vaishya class is more of that, in that wealth oriented, business oriented, and they are have secondarily is tamas. Okay, and tamas means that the dharma is not shining very brightly, you know. It's not necessarily even there. You know? That's why in that chapter 17 of the Bhagavad Gita, that someday we'll get to, right, that chapter 17, that nature of what we call an asura is somebody who is predominantly tamas. A vaishya has tamas really secondarily, you know. That means they have a lot of energy and a lot of power, but they are more self-centered. They don't have that sattva buddhi, that sattvika buddhi, that gives them that sense of dharma and ananda. So that's considered to be the vaishya. And then the tamas are predominantly sattva with rajas. So this is just a categorization that is made. I don't think in the caste system that's happening right now, there's not really very much left of it. All there is are kind of, what do you call it? Certain prejudices. There's prejudices, but not very much knowledge. But when you go into studying what they are in terms of what they were in antiquity, or when you go really back into the past when the culture was bright, there's a categorization that actually you can, all beings can fit into. Though we may not have expressed it, you can see in the culture that there are people who are suited, you know, to say, suited to study in academics and meditation, or suited to become priests or ministers. There's that kind of category of people. There's other people that are very suited for political office and suited for joining the armed services. That's another category. It's another category of people that are the businessmen, the entrepreneurs, the people who are trying to make it in the world and become wealthy. There's that category of people. And then there's the category of people, the shudras that are actually serving all of the others, like they're all the workers, all of the people that work to support all of these other institutions, though they're called the shudras. And so they are not necessarily that self-motivated. It doesn't mean that they're not alert. It doesn't mean that they can't do a good job or anything like that. It just means that in this categorization, they're the people, you know, that would just rather do an 8-to-5 and do your duty and then come home and be with your family. You know? And a lot of people like that. My brother's really like that, and he's proud of it too. He's retired. He said, just let me do my job. Let me do my job. I can do it. I want to be able to just come home and not think about it anymore. And he was happy to do that. It was kind of boring. He didn't want his kids to do that. He wanted to make sure his kids all got a big education and all of that. But for him, you know, to just be able to have that emotional, mental, emotional freedom and not to carry work home with it, he was grateful for that. So, anyway, just a little aside there. So here, for the brahmana, so Shankara will say in his commentary, really mean the one who has the sattvika buddhi, so the mumukshu. It's not really, you can't contain that to a caste. If you were born a brahmana, so for a brahmana, you can be the one who gets knowledge. It would amount to that. So it's not contained in that. So one that has that satvika buddhi, you know, that relative shanti, and who is suited to pursue this knowledge, because the Gita Shastra is really a moksha shastra and karma yoga. Karma yoga itself goes with the one who's pursuing self-knowledge. Karma yoga doesn't belong to samsara. It's not for the samsari. It's for the person who is pursuing knowledge. So what it says here is, for the brahmana, it's for the one who has that sattvika buddhi, who knows what it's all about, either, in the bhasha it would say, either in terms of karma yoga, or in terms of jnana nishtha, rootedness, or clarity, inner knowledge. In either case, this pursuing the karma kanda, the flowery words of the Vedas, which are listing all various sorts of karmas that I can utilize to gain things that I think will make me happy. All of those are as much use as a well when it's flooded by water. So it's even true for the mumukshu, because the mumukshu, the one who's studying, who's gaining this knowledge, recognizes that difference already. Even though their mind may not have the sattva, they might not have the clear understanding, I just abiding myself, still they know. And so this is not comparable. Gaining karmas is like the difference. Working for these karmas, for these small pleasures, is nothing compared to making the effort that's required for gaining self-knowledge. One is the ananda, the very ananda that we're trying to get out of these karmas. So that's the difference. Okay, so let's start with this one.
Karmanyeva vikaraste mapaleshu kadachana mapaleshu kadachana ma karma phala hetur bhuhu ma karma phala hetur bhuhu ma te sangostva karmani.
Sindhi, karmani eva adhikaraha. See those sindhis? Karmani eva. That ya is an e. That ya is an e that's become ya to take on the a. So if you were to say really fast, say just to give you a little time to do the Sanskrit. Say quickly the letter e and a together.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I put these two vowels together, that ya is born. Okay. So now say ea.
Yeah.
So in this case, it's E plus A coming together, you know, and that makes yay. Naturally, your vocal cords will, your whole stung, the whole apparatus for making sound will produce this yakara. That's why it's called a semi-vowel. So when two vowels are in, certain vowels are coming together, they actually produce that semi-vowel sound. So this sandhi, you see karmani eva. Karmani eva. If I say it fast, karmani eva. Karmani eva. Karmani eva. Karmani eva. Karmani eva. And then eva and adhikara. Right? So a plus a, eva and adhikara. That's a plus a. Then it's a. Right? Long a. So karmani eva adhikara ste. If I say eva adhikari, eva adhikari, that it's going to be elongated as I am rattling along. So karmani eva adhikaraha te. Visarga becomes is, so karmani eva adhikaraha te ma paleshu kadachana. Ma karma pala hetuhu. See that order? Hetuhu, hetur, hetuhu. Visarga, there's a lot of rules for this visarga. Like if I say ramaha, that ha It's just called Visarga. Harihi, that he, Visarga. Right? If you're looking at the Sanskrit, you'll see these two little dots. You know, if you're looking at the transliteration, there'll be an H with a dot underneath it. So we're used in Sanskrit to hearing like Ramaha, you know, Harihi, or Ashwaha, all this Aha, Guruhu. You know, that's the Visarga. But there's many times in, when a Visarga is being followed by another little letter, it'll change its form. So here, if you see Ma Karma Pala Hetur, that's Hetuhu. That's the Visarga that become Ar. And then Bur, Buhu. Again, the Visarga has become Ar. Then Ma Te, then Sangaha Astu. There the U and the A. Like if I say U, Ua, really fast, Ua, Ua, Ua. That wa is the sound of the Ya, Ra, La, Wa is the pure sound, actually. So Ua, Ua. So that would be, we say Wa becomes Va also in certain pronunciation, in certain circumstances. So Sangaha, Astu, Akaramani. So this this verse is where Krishna starts teaching Karma Yoga. This is the introduction to the verse to Karma Yoga, and it's a very famous verse. It's one that Swamiji rattles off all the time when he's teaching. It's really the core, the essence of understanding that Karma Yoga Bhakti. And if you have yet, I don't know if you've all gotten the Gita Home Study. Does everybody have it? Gita Home Study? Yeah. This Swamiji's commentary on this is several pages. It's very, very thorough because this really is the introductory verse. Even though Shankara's Bhashya is quite small, this is the introductory verse to the karma. Everything up to this point has been praised. You, up to this point, you don't know from the Gita really what Karma Yoga actually is. So what he says here is that karmani eva, in reference to karma, this is locative karmani, regarding karma, regarding any action, regarding karma is just an action. We can take it as a ritual, but it really stands for any action that you do. So regarding the karma, adhikarahate, you know, your adhikara means really your qualification or your right. What are you qualified for in any karma? He says, in reference to for you, your adhikara, the adhikara, your right, is in deciding what karma to do. I will do this because I have, as a human being, I have free choice. It's just some gift that we have, even though you can argue about it, you can say, well, there really isn't any free choice, or there's very little tiny bit of free choice, or is there really even free choice at all? However you want to say it, we can say we're tremendously influenced. Our free choice is tremendously influenced by the prarabdha karma, by the situation we find ourselves in, by our past experiences, by our history. It so overwhelmingly influences your free choice. But that does not mean that you don't have free choice. You have free choice within that container, right? It's not like there's no free choice. It's just that the free choice is heavily influenced. That's true. But nevertheless, you can do something. You can take an action. You can do that action differently. So kind of the three things we have. You can do a given action. You can do it differently. Or you cannot do it. Right? You've got that choice. So Bhagavan says, you know, your adhikara, your right, your qualification, your right is in reference to the karma itself. It means toward the action, your decision to do the action. So you have that power. You have free choice, he says. But he says, ma paleshu kadachana. But never, ma kadachana. But never toward the results. There are two words here. Karma pala. Karma pala is another very, very often used word. Everything's, well, this is my karmapala. We can say the whole Prarabdha karma, this is my karmapala. All of the karmas that are fructifying now from my birth to my death, that's the karmapala. Right? Those are the results of my actions. You have a right, an adhikara, a qualification over choosing your actions or desisting from them, whatever you decide to do. But in terms of the karmapala that comes to you, you don't have any qualification at all. You actually have nothing to say about that. We'll look at that in a minute. So, ma palesha kadachana. Then he says, ma karmapala hetuhu. That being the case, that you have some rights over your action, but not over the pala, the karmapala, may you never become ma buhu. May you not be, what? Karma pala hetuhu. A person, this is a buhuvihi, one who considers themselves one who is the cause of the karma pala. Don't go there. Don't ever identify with that. That you actually, hetu means cause. You are the one who brings about, because of you, this karma pala has taken place. As though that you are the cause of that karma pala. Don't go there. Don't ever become that. Ma is a negation. May you not. It's an imperative negation. May you not become that. It's actually, just for Sanskrit people, the ma buhu. That buhu is actually an aorist that has dropped its and the aorist can be used with ma as an imperative. So ma buhu, may you not become a karma pala hetuhu. Hetu is another really common word beneath the cause. May you never become, in your own mind, you know, the one who is the cause of the karmapala. And then he says, so don't let that happen to you. May that never happen to you. And then, te sangaha astu akarmani. And also, may your sangha means your attachment or commitment to or your inclination. May you, having thought, well, all of these karmas are a pain, just a pain anyway. They just create so much problem. So let me just not do anything. Let's just not do anything. So he says, don't ever have that inclination. Let that sangha, that inclination, toward akarma, let that never be there. So it says, ma te sangaha, there's two ma's. You see the first one, ma karma palahetuhu buhu, and then ma te sangaha astu akarmani. Never go here. Never say, okay, I'm just not going to do anything. Let me just sit around. I don't want to do anything. No. You have to, he's telling Arjuna, no, you have to go to the battlefield and fight and do your dharma. You have to keep up that energy. Do what is being asked of you, and do it with energy. Don't just sit back, because Arjuna was doing that. He actually sat back in his chariot, just plopped down in the chariot, and he just sat back and he said, I'm not going to fight. And he plopped down and just kind of looked up, having totally lost all his energy. I'm not going to fight. And so Krishna's actually talking to him. Don't go there. Don't make this resolve that now I'm just not going to do anything. That's also not right. You have to do the karmas that come to you. You have to live in the world, living out your prarabdha karma. You make the choices. You follow the dharma. You have the freedom to respond to the life that is unfolding before you. But you don't have any control over the karma pala. But this is actually important thing to recognize. Because if you had control over the karma pala, the results of your action, then there would be no problem. You know? You just make the decision of what you want, you go after it, and you get it. It's very, very simple. But that simply isn't the case. Swamiji has used a made-up example, but it's a good example. He uses two young men. Say there's two young men, both of very similar family structure, you know. Both have the same amount of wealth, the same amount of education, same amount of finances, same amount of education. They're well situated in the world. They have good friends. They're mentally, emotionally very similar. There's no real difference other than they're two different people, right? They're two different people, and they have two parabdha karmas, right? One, everything opens up. He says, we're both entrepreneurs starting a very similar business. For the one, everything opens up. All the opportunities are just blossoming. And he just skates through his new entrepreneurial endeavor, you know, with so many opportunities, so many things flowering, and becomes such a success. And this other fellow, you know, he's equally competent, but as he tries to do a similar business, nothing opens up, everything goes wrong, you know. Even the place that he was renting for the business, the landlords decided to do something else with it and pull it out from under him. There's no end to the kind of the catastrophe of his endeavor. So why? You know? Because both are dharmis, both are good people, both are intelligent, both have good intent, you know. Why should one get such a raw deal and the other person just slides through? You can say, well, but we would, an Indian would say, well, that's my, an Indian themselves would say, that's my prarabdha. That's my prarabdha, right? That's karmapala, you know. That's my karmapala. They just go there. They go there because the culture itself kind of recognizes that I cannot control. I can do my very best, and I should do my very, very best. As Swamiji says, I do my best every moment. Yeah, I just, what comes to me, I do my very best. He doesn't say, I do my very best and I'm always successful. He doesn't even think about being successful or not being successful. This is the Karma Yoga Buddhi, and it's the Buddhi of Ajnani. You do what is to be done to the best of your ability, and you accept the fruits of your actions with that prasada buddhi, because you really don't have control over it. You have to think about this, the reality of this. Just think, the best way to think about it, I think, is think about, what if you did have control over it? What would that mean? You know, you make a decision to do something, you have control over the karma pulley, you have a control over the result, so you just do it and you get the result. Yeah. That is nobody's experience. Yeah. There are too many variables. For one thing, there's too many people. In any endeavor, there's too many people, there's too many situations, there's too many variables besides just besides you. Right? There's too many variables, there's too many unknown variables, there's too much divam. Divam is the prarabdha. But even without looking at the prarabdha karma, there's too many variables. There's too many people involved, there's too many laws involved, in which country are you trying to pull this thing off? All of these variables are continually there, and so you can't count on it. The result is not a given. And so what if we think it's supposed to be a given? I don't think we think it's supposed to be a given. I think we don't think about it. You know, and so then I can become very disappointed when I don't get my way, as though I should get my way. Should I get my way? There's no promise there that I will get my way. And so what if your commitment, your sangha, that sangha here in the sense of attachment, is that you get your way and you have no control over getting your way, you can only do the actions. You have control over the actions, that's all. And then you can hope for the best and see what comes. So what Krishna says, you take what comes as prasad from me. Because I actually, and what we call the Bhagavan talking, I am the karmapala datta. The karmapala datta, this is another word that is used all the time. I am the giver. I am the one who gives the fruits of the actions. According to all of the laws of karma, all of the fruits of actions come from me alone. You know? You be responsible for the dharma. for what you decide to do and how you do it. What you want to do, that's your responsibility. But then receive everything with that, what we call Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. That means that I receive Ishvara, the Lord, Arpana. Arpana means that worship or puja, right? That with that attitude. Buddhi here means attitude. So Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, that attitude of puja, that attitude of worship of Bhagavan. I do, and so this gets into, this causes your attitude, as you kind of recognize all of this, and as you become more and more, you know, desirous of, I'd say, liberation, this Ishvara Arpana Buddhi can, is something that I will employ or use, even in reference to my desires. I want this, Bhagavan, please, I want this, so I'm going to try, please bless me. And I say all of that and do all of these things. I really want this and I want things to go like this and I'm going to make every effort for that. Please give me your blessings. You say that prayer. Now that's it, that's it. That's Shraddha, you know. That's a Karma Nishtha. And that's somebody who has Shraddha in the Vedas and in Bhagavan. So you pray, you know, that my endeavor will go well and you can even do some pujas for it. People do that at the beginning of any endeavor. And you pray. But sometimes Bhagavan says no. You know, no, that's not right for you. So whatever it is. So you pray and you try to fulfill this particular desire and it doesn't come. Something else comes. Right? Something happens, but not what you had wanted. In fact, more than what you wanted could happen, or less than what you wanted, or you could get the opposite. Anything can happen. So when you get that result, how do you receive it? Well, as a mumukshu, you receive it with that as prasad. You take it from Ishwara as a communication, as a dialogue with Ishwara, you know, and you take it as prasad. But it goes further than that because as your mind, as you with your knowledge, as you start to really understand that fulfilling all of these karmas, fulfilling all of these actions, you know, fulfilling my desires are really like running over to the well, which is already totally flooded with water, but you decide that you want your water from the well, which is in the middle of the flood, okay? And so, this is your situation as a mumukshu, as a jnani. As a jnani, of course, but even as a mumukshu, because as a mumukshu, you're starting to recognize that any experience of ananda is really only myself. But what I'm still stuck on is working for the fulfillment of some karma, some action I undertake, so that I can get that little piece of ananda from that moment of desirelessness, which is really only a moment, the moment of desirelessness that is brought about from the fulfillment of that action. And so that is what habitually I keep working for, creating my life, creating a situation that will make me happy. But for a jnani or for a mumukshu, what you keep recognizing is that actually the ananda that I'm experiencing in that little moment of desirelessness has its source only in me. There is no objectifiable ananda. You know, I can't look at something, anything in the world, let alone ananda itself. But if I say, let's take a look at ananda. What does ananda look like? Does it have a nama rupa? Does it have some sort of a form that we can describe to everybody? Say, oh no, of course not. It doesn't have a form. When I experience the ananda, I am ananda. I am the one who becomes happy. But that object, that situation, is what gave me that happiness. That's what made me happy. And we have to really analyze that and say, well, actually, that object or that situation, it's not that it gave you the happiness or beamed the happiness at you. It's that because you have given it, you have projected that ananda, that being the source of ananda, onto that situation. Then when you desire it, because you're desiring the ananda, when you get that thing, then your mind totally relaxes, you know, and you experience the ananda. I want that so I can be happy. That is the illusion. I want that so badly. Bhagavan, please let me have it. I want that so badly so that I can be happy. That's the desire. And so when you get it, what happens? The mind goes, whew, you're desireless. And that goes hand in hand with the experience of being happy. So you get a relaxed vritti, a relaxed thought modification, which allows for the experience of happiness. And then you put two and two together. See, when I was able to accomplish that desired object, I became happy. And so therefore the fulfillment of my desires, right, make me happy. That's the logic, because it works, you know. You fulfill any desire in the world and the mind gains some shanti. And in that shanti, there is well-being. So we have to dissect this whole thing. In class, we dissect all of this for the mumukshu, the one who is studying, to see what is really happening. And we ask, you know, in the fulfillment of these desires and all of these karma, in the karma khandas, doing all of these rituals and everything in order to get these things that I want so badly, the fulfillment of these desires, what do they really give you? Actually, what really happens? Well, what really happens is in that moment, I become desireless. When you are desireless, you don't want anything. Everything is fine. I am whole and complete. There's no one saying I need this or I need that to be happy. You're ananda itself. And so for that moment, all is well with me. But what has really caused that? It's not anything out here. What has caused it is the shantavritti. Because that shantavritti, like a clear mirror reflecting the sun is just pulsating, in a sense, in that mirror. My mind becomes clean, sattvika, relatively complete shanti. And in that, my being as though shines and reflects. I would say that reflection in that moment of ananda that we experience, or any ananda that we experience in a shantavritti, is a bit different than the ananda of myself.